Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Welcome everyone to the OMFIF podcast. I'm John Orchard, OMFIF CEO. Today we're joined by Lady Suzanne Hayward to discuss her fascinating and moving book, What Does Jeremy Think? Jeremy Hayward and the Making of Modern Britain. On one level, this book is a history of British politics and government since the 1990s, including three major crises seen through the career of one man who was at the heart of it all in various roles. On another, it's a touching personal story of dedication to duty in the face of personal tragedy. And on another, it's a study on the way the British state works. Alongside Suzanne to discuss the book and the many issues it raises, we're delighted to have two OMFIF associates with hinterlands in this area. Firstly, the chair of OMFIF's advisory board, Lord Desai, and also Lord Lamont, who is on the board too and whose chancellorship and working relationship with Jeremy set the story in motion at the beginning of the book. McNabb and Norman, over to you.
Let me ask you, first of all, in all the various crises that we have been reading about, well, the first one, the crisis of the ERM crisis, because we have Norman here to also add his sort of part in it.
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me on this. I'm absolutely delighted to join you today. I think Jeremy would say it wasn't the worst. I mean, it was a very, very tough time, and I'm sure Norman will kind of add to that as well. And I think Jeremy learned a lot from living through the ERM crisis back in 1992. But I think when I asked him what the most difficult things were that he faced during his career, he cited the financial crisis in 2007, 2008, 2009. And then secondly, of course, Brexit, which sadly he wasn't able to see all the way through. But those were the two policy crises of his career. But he learned a lot from Black Wednesday. And I think that actually was very, very helpful for him later on when he faced those other crises.
Norman, you want to add your reflections on this?
Well, not very much. I mean, it was wonderful. Jeremy at my side during that very, very difficult crisis. I think what Suzanne has said is right, that compared with crises that came subsequently, it was actually quite small. And actually, I think it was much more of a political crisis than an economic crisis. The effects of leaving the ERM turned out actually to work very well, and not at all as had been forecast and been expecting. But it was wonderful for me to have Jeremy there. Jeremy had worked for me in two other jobs as Chief Secretary and Financial Secretary. And I always felt Jeremy, of all officials I ever came across, he was the one who was always constructive. You know, when one got submissions coming up from the civil service saying, here's three options, they're all very difficult, he would say, well, there might be a better option four, a better option five, and a better option six. And if you were told something was impossible, he would say, I'm not so sure it's impossible. I mean, he was a problem solver. And I must say, I treasured every minute working with him.
Very good. Let me continue with that. I've been reading Oliver Letwin's memoirs, and he also mentions the unpompous emails that Jeremy used to write compared to all the other civil servant people who were obfuscating the stuff. Let me ask you another question. Basically, what it looks like is that there is all sorts of caste system of who is in, who is out, and who can do something, who cannot do something. And Jeremy obviously had different roles at different times. How did he manage this difficult transition? Because whether you're in the private office or whether you are running the civil service or whatever it is, it must have required different kind of ability of the many abilities that he had.
Well, I'm sure that's right. Although, you know, in many ways, Jeremy didn't really change his style all the way through. When you look at the kind of the basic things that he did were really quite consistent. And he started doing a lot of these things when he was working with Norman in all of those roles that Norman has just talked about, where he learned a kind of huge amount. Jeremy really believed in, first of all, working in a very non-hierarchical way. So he would reach out to anybody at any level and ask them. And one of the kind of great things that he had, which, of course, he built over time, was this increasingly large network, both within government and outside of government. So if you look at him in the middle of the financial crisis in the book, you know, he is kind of busy reaching out to people in the city. He's busy reaching out to people across the whole of Whitehall. He's reaching out to people more broadly in the private sector. And that network was incredibly helpful and was very non-hierarchical. He would talk to anybody who he thought would be useful. He believed in open policy making. So not just having a Whitehall-centric view of the world, but getting outside of Whitehall and getting people who knew what was going on close to the ground to do things. And he was a huge believer, not in being political, because the civil service is not political, but in understanding what the world looks like through a politician's eyes. And again, that's something he learnt very early on, kind of working with Norman, and is a huge, hugely important skill if you're a civil servant, is to understand, not to be political yourself, but to understand what the kind of motivations and needs are of a politician, so that you do serve up policy options that that do what a minister needs to have done. And I would say that all of those kind of characteristics Jeremy kind of kept with him all the way through those different roles. Now, the roles he was playing evolved. You know, he took on more and more responsibility across the whole of the civil service, but those basic working characteristics, I think, remained very much the same.
One of the things that has struck me in the book is the extent to which government policy seems to be driven by what the press is about to say or has just said. Do you think that's a fair characterization? It seemed that Jeremy had to consider that almost above all other things in these crises.
I think he would say that it's certainly not primarily driven by that. I would hope not, because it would make everything incredibly short term. But this comes back a little bit to seeing the world through a politician's eyes. I mean, politicians are elected and the electorate is affected by what the press says. So if you're a minister, as Norman will know, you are very affected by particularly kind of stories that start to gain real traction in the press. And you can't ignore that. You ignore that at your peril, I think, if you're a minister. So I think if you are a successful civil servant, you will be watching what's happening in the media and at least seeking to reflect that in what you put forward. But quite a number of the policies that Jeremy certainly pursued or kind of advocated were not necessarily the most popular policies. But it's very, very true to say that there are kind of points in the story, like, for example, when Gordon Brown is given a very tough press coverage over Afghanistan, when, you know, the impact of the press felt very heavy within Number 10. And also, of course, the various kind of crises, you know, particularly kind of crises over things like kind of press regulation. Those always had a very, very big impact on the centre.
What I remember the major years when I was just in the House of Lords entered, and we used to say that you read the Daily Mail in the morning to see what the government is going to do in the afternoon, and then you read the Evening Standard, and you know they'll have a different set of policies because by that time another scandal had broken out. I think the same thing was also true sometimes in the Tony Blair thing. You know, you have to always look at how the media are interpreting, because as you know, you're saying, it influences how politicians think about what the people are thinking. That's the only way they can find out. So of all the prime ministers that he had to work with, which did he like best?
Well, I mean, Jeremy would never, ever answer that question. What I did ask him, so a question he was willing to answer, was what did he admire the different prime ministers for? So Now, when I asked him that question, what he said was, you know, that he admired Tony Blair for the public sector reform that he did.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of public sector reform, which is often now forgotten because, of course, it was overshadowed by other events. But if you read the book, you know, there's lots and lots of reform that's going on, everything from, you know, foundation hospitals to the minimum wage. I mean, a lot of change happened during that period. And Jeremy found that very kind of satisfying. Under Gordon Brown, of course, it was the financial crisis, and that was the kind of the biggest issue that he lived all the way through. And he was very proud of what they achieved there. And actually, it was only when I was writing the book that I fully understood how close we came to a complete banking collapse during that period. I mean, it was also the only period that I remember when Jeremy had sleepless nights. He had this phenomenal ability to remain cool under pressure, but it fell apart a little bit in the middle of that period. And he hugely admired kind of Gordon for his ability to get right into the detail of what was happening then. And then under the coalition, first of all, the coalition was incredibly functional when it first came in.
You know, actually,
and it, again, it's quite kind of interesting. You would think it would be more difficult, but actually the formality required to manage two parties in government from a civil service point of view made it very effective. A lot of work was done, particularly in the early stage. The later stage of the coalition was very difficult. And again, they got a lot of things decided. I mean, everything from, you know, same-sex marriages and a whole series of different things. The work they did on Alzheimer's, Jeremy felt very passionate about, and dementia. His mother, sadly, suffers from dementia. And then I think he really admired Mrs. May for her determination to implement the Brexit decision in an incredibly difficult circumstance. And he was, you know, and again, I think this becomes very clear in the story, and it's quite difficult to read, actually. This was why he was so determined to keep working right up until almost the end. I mean, it was literally a week before he died. He was still trying to work on that because it was a problem that had not been solved and one that he felt that he needed to try and help her get through.
So I want to ask you a little bit on your view, or rather Jeremy's view, as you understand it, on the tension between the Treasury and the Prime Minister. That's often in the story that you described. You also met Jeremy in the Treasury. Was his view, do you think, that the Treasury was overmighty and that the Prime Minister's office was insufficiently strong? I mean, he seemed to be somewhat addressing that balance, having done, been on both sides of the equation.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because I think in the book, that that tension between number 10 and number 11 is always present. I mean, it changes its shape and form at various points as you get different chancellors and different prime ministers coming in. But it's always present. I mean, in fact, the only point at which it's not really present is in the first part of the kind of coalition, where there was a huge amount of alignment between Cameron and Osborne. But otherwise, that tension is always there. I think Jeremy would say that that is a very, in general, it was a very healthy tension. I mean, even when the personalities made it somewhat dysfunctional, that tension between the Treasury, which holds the purse strings and tends to have a very, very kind of clean economic view of what the policy should be, and the Prime Minister, who's trying to hold together the whole of Cabinet with all of the different kind of interests that Cabinet has, that is a natural tension, which in a way is usually very productive because it forces the debate at the highest level about what should be done, what the right policy outcome is. So I would be, I mean, various people say, you know, maybe that tension should be removed. Maybe we should kind of combine it all into a kind of centre of government that does all of it. I personally think, having kind of spent the time I did on the book, that that tension is painful, but in the pain is an awful lot of kind of productivity or kind of good debate.
I think what people often forget is that the Chancellor Exchequer or the Treasury are in a minority in the government, and they have a minority of focus, because what they are interested in above all is balancing the books. It's not the only thing that they're interested in, but it is a prime objective. And time and time again, Chancellor's Exchequer are accused of being non-political, by which people mean, oh, we won't let me spend a little bit of money, which would do such a lot of good. And you always have a tension for that reason. The Prime Minister is more political. He is always thinking perhaps about the next election. But the influence of the Chancellor Exchequer depends on the support of the Prime Minister. If the Prime Minister does not support the Chancellor, he's sunk. So, you know, discipline of a financial kind can only be maintained in a government provided the Prime Minister backs the Chancellor.
I wanted to explore about this exactly, that with the Chancellor-Prime Minister conflict was the greatest under Blair and Brown. But somehow they managed to get a lot of work done. But when Brown was Prime Minister, you know, there are a lot of differences with Alistair Darling. And it seems from the account that in solving the financial crisis, Alistair was very much the junior partner, and Brown was doing everything along with Jeremy.
Well, it does have to be remembered that, of course, I'm writing the book from Jeremy's perspective.
Sure.
See that as we kind of go along. So, you know, during the, you know, when Brown was Prime Minister, Jeremy was sitting on that side of the divide. And at other points, he was sitting on the kind of Treasury side. So, so I'm sure that to some extent, because people are reading it through his perspective, that will change. Mm. But I think you're right. I mean, whether or not a kind of Chancellor-Prime Minister relationship works well depends to some extent on the personal relationship between the two, which, as we all know, and is very public, was very difficult for a period between Blair and Brown. However, you know, Blair and Brown, actually, when you got down to the policy differences, I would argue they weren't that great. I mean, there were differences in terms of positioning. So if you look at a debate like the debate that they had on foundation hospitals, a lot of that was around positioning. You know, Gordon Brown was very concerned about a policy that might look like the nationalisation of the, you know, about the sale of the NHS, the privatisation of the NHS, whereas Tony Blair was very concerned about public sector reform. So have a difference. But I would argue those differences were relatively small, actually. But the interpersonal relationship between them was very difficult. And so I think that's kind of ideally what you want between your Chancellor and your Prime Minister is you want a good working relationship, possibly not too close a working relationship, because if it gets too close, you're not going to have that challenge, and you need an alignment on policy. And it's quite an interesting exercise to kind of think through, well, where does that, you know, where has that worked very well and where has that worked more difficult? You know, where has that been more difficult? I mean, I would argue actually in many ways, the relationship between kind of Ken Clark and John Major was a very good relationship because they had quite a lot of alignment. But there wasn't that tension that existed between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair.
One of the interesting things is that I think it's only in Britain that the Chancellery Exchequer, the Finance Minister, and the Prime Minister live next door to each other and have a connecting door. And I know this used to amaze finance ministers in Europe. They thought it was wonderful, but I'm not sure it always produced results.
But also very interesting thing was Blair and Brown were the closest friends and became the most quarreling pair of Prime Minister and Chancellor because of Gordon's feeling that he had been wronged somehow and he should be Prime Minister. But they were the closest of friends even more than Cameron and Osborne. I mean, they've been together and they shared the office when they became MPs and all that.
And as I say, you know, but as we all know, even in our kind of own lives, sometimes the people who you're closest to at one point in your life, it won't kind of stay like that. And there was clearly a lot of kind of hinterland and kind of things that both sides felt bitter about. What was interesting, though, and I found this quite interesting to try and kind of bring to life as I was writing it, is despite the fact that that relationship deteriorated, and it did deteriorate, actually the, you know, number 10 and number 11 were still able to function, mainly because, you know, there was this connection between Jeremy and Ed Balls, Gordon's chief advisor, and they would meet and debate things in Churchill's Cafe on Whitehall, which wasn't a particularly nice cafe. Norman may remember it. It was a kind of formica table, you know, really horrible coffee. But a lot of Treasury number 10 business was hammered out over the formica tables. And it was done there because it was neutral territory. It was neither the Treasury nor was it number 10. And if they got it agreed there, then they could each take it back to their principals. And that meant that the work of government could continue. So not ideal by any means. I mean, I don't think anyone would advocate that is a good way to decide kind of government policy. But I think what it does show is that the, you know, Whitehall is amazingly flexible. It's perceived as being very inflexible, but actually a way is usually found to get things done and get things decided.
I was reflecting today on reading the book and the extraordinary amount of work that Jeremy had to do. Whether that represented an institutionally a missing cog somewhere in the government or the interface between the civil service and the government. Do you think that's true? Is it because he chose to work that hard or is there something missing in this interface between public opinion, press, treasury, prime ministers and so forth? He seemed to be the interface between a lot of different things.
It's a great question, and it's one that I've kind of pondered, because, you know, kind of posed another way, when Jeremy disappeared, particularly because he disappeared so suddenly, quite a lot of people have said to me he left a very big hole. And you can see that as a kind of compliment in a funny sort of way, but you could also see it as a criticism. You know, none of us should, if we suddenly disappeared, leave such a big hole. You know, you don't want to leave a hole. You should be trying to kind of create an ability within the organization that you leave to be able to continue when you're not there. The problem, I think, is, and this is quite interesting, the way in which government is structured, department by department, they are pretty autonomous, as we all know, and then it only really comes together in the Cabinet Office, a little bit in number 10, with a relatively small group of people who pull everything together across these autonomous departments to make sure that you get joined up policy that works for the Cabinet. And you could try and put in place kind of processes to do that more effectively. You could try and make the Cabinet Office a lot bigger. I worry you would end up with an awful lot of bureaucracy. So the way in which they solve it at the moment is by having a few people who know how to get around the system and pull everything together. But the downside of it is you then become very dependent on a few individuals. So it's a great question, because, as I say, it's both a kind of criticism and a compliment that there was such a hole immediately after he disappeared.
I think there's another element to it, possibly. I don't know whether you'd agree with this, Suzanne. I mean, I think in some ways the system is centralized, but it's centralized in the sense that ministers are accountable to Parliament. And because they're accountable for everything in their department, everything has to be signed off. And a submission will come up, having gone to different ministers, gone to different civil servants, they've all added their little bit to it, and then it comes to the cabinet minister, and he is to sign it off, because he is the one who will have to stand up in Parliament, and even if it's a very trivial matter, possibly, he'll be asked why he didn't do something about it. And it's the accountability to Parliament means that everything, to some extent, has to be shoved right up to the very top.
What I found very interesting reading Suzanne's book, it's like looking at an X-ray picture of a human body. The thing that you can't see on the surface, all the interstices and connections. And when you mention the Jeremy Edbold's link, it's very interesting. There are on the surface the ministers and so on, and then beneath that, not just the civil service, but the fact that Edbold had a vague status. He was not actually a cabinet minister, maybe, at least to begin with, but he was a special advisor. I mean, he was always sitting next to Gordon, because Gordon needed Ed all the time. I've been to a couple of those meetings, and it was Ed who ran the meeting, and Gordon listened, and at some stage Gordon got up and went away, and Ed did the rest of the thing. But had that kind of informal link not been there, there would have been a clogging, you know. When they say joined up government, it actually shows how fragmented the government is. You have to join it up. And then also what Norman mentioned about Parliament, because even your own party's members can give you hell if they take it with, and you are exposed in public. So I think, you know, where the civil servants can't help you. So it's very complicated stuff, the way the government sort of is structured. And what is the way the government works? Because I've been observing how much it doesn't work, but that's my view of it. But the Theresa May thing, I mean, it is her MPs which kind of ruined Brexit. And I remember we've been very much arguing that was the best deal we were going to have. And I don't think it was the opposition which killed it. It basically the her own party. In a kind of through a tantrum, and it's a difficult thing for the civil servant to manage when the politics is dysfunctional.
One of the things I remember, Suzanne, very much was Jeremy getting more and more interested in Parliament, and he actually became quite enthusiastic about watching Parliament and watching the reaction of backbenchers to things one said, and Nicky had very shrewd observations about that. Again, I didn't come across that in many civil servants. They thought they gave you a piece of paper and what happened in Parliament was up to you. But Jeremy actually took an interest in it.
I mean, Jeremy was very conscious that, you know, particularly for some governments, the way in which Parliament reacts to a policy is absolutely critical. Now, obviously, it depends very much on the size of a majority. So when he was working for Blair, who had a very, very significant majority, I think it's fair to say that there was less attention paid to what was happening in Parliament within Number 10, because by and large, most policies, so long as they were in line with the manifesto, would go through. But there were certainly other times, so for example, during the Brexit debate, when Jeremy was obsessed with what was happening in Parliament, because there was no way that he could give Theresa May good advice on Brexit without having a pretty nuanced idea of where everybody was in her own party. As you say, it wasn't just the opposition, it was her own party. So if we go back to the point about, you know, to be a good civil servant, you need to see the world through a politician's eyes. A politician with a very large majority, you may not have to worry too much about what's happening in Parliament. But if you have a politician with a small majority or a very divided party, then to be a good civil servant, you've got to be acutely interested in that, which Jeremy certainly was.
Maybe we are concentrating or have concentrated a bit too much on Blair and Brown and the Labour government. Of course, it was a very long period. But I think it would be interesting to hear from Suzanne whether, just as she had to negotiate with Ed Balls in a cafe in Whitehall, whether he had to do similar negotiations between the different parts of the coalition, or was the coalition cohesive? How did Jeremy find dealing with the two-headed monster that was the coalition?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, the funny thing was, I think, you know, civil servants were quite worried about how a coalition was going to work, because we have to remember, you know, the UK had not really had a coalition government for a very long time. And so there was quite a lot of concern about how functional a coalition government would be. But what was quite interesting is certainly the first half of the coalition, as I was saying before, you know, it required quite a lot of formality. So because you had two different parties in government, both of which needed to have their views kind of clearly represented, you needed to document every decision very clearly, you need to have good debates about each decision. So from Jeremy's point of view, from the civil services point of view, actually it was very good for governance to have a coalition. And because the coalition had put together the coalition agreement right at the start, they actually were pretty aligned on policy as well. So that kind of first part of the coalition, where you had the benefit of the very clear structured governance and a clear coalition agreement, actually was a very productive kind of period where there wasn't a lot of need for Jeremy to do the kind of bilateral negotiation that he had to do, funnily enough, under a kind of single party with kind of Blair and Brown. Now, when you then come into the second part of the coalition, of course, the story changes quite significantly. When you're running up to an election, you have the two parties increasingly concerned to differentiate themselves. You have the smaller party at a massive disadvantage and feeling kind of pretty, you know, pretty hard done by on multiple counts, and relationships becoming increasingly frayed. And in that period, the so-called kind of quad, which was the group of the Chancellor, Prime Minister, Chief Secretary, and the Deputy Prime Minister, became very, very important as a decision-making body, and Jeremy was part of that, a little bit like the kind of Jeremy Ed Balls grouping had been under under the Blair Brown administration.
I'm just pushing a little bit further on that. I've been reading David Cameron's sort of memoirs to check up on the House of Lords thing, because the thing broke on the House of Lords and the boundaries issue. I mean, it's very interesting. That's something in which Jeremy could not help all that very much, because this is a political battle. And I think the House of Lords bill was actually a very good bill. I remember, you know, the joint committee of the both houses reported on that and so on. And then it all fell apart and it disappeared from the face of the earth after all that hard work. And the politicians could quarrel and the civil servant just had to. Was that very frustrating that the thing was falling apart and there's nothing very much the civil servant could do?
Well, there were definitely a whole series of policy issues where the civil service had to step back because they were highly political. I mean, a lot of the stuff, for example, around Leveson, they were very careful about. They were very careful about issues like House of Lords reform. So Jeremy, you know, did give some advice and was aware of what was happening on that. But really, it was a political debate. So he didn't get kind of directly involved in trying to get things sorted. And of course, it did come at quite a difficult point in the coalition. And of course, the two sides of the coalition weren't very aligned on what they wanted from House of Lords reform. So it was always going to be quite a difficult debate.
What do you think, Suzanne, about the essential structure of government, whether it needed reforming? And we saw attempts to put a hard rein on the civil service towards the end of the last year. The proponent for those has moved on, and we haven't heard much of it since. But did Jeremy think that the structure itself needed much reform, or did it just need a little bit of spring cleaning?
So Jeremy was always a reformer. He was always quite a maverick, actually, and he stood out quite a lot in that sort of way. In fact, as I say in the book, one of the reasons why he was reluctant to become head of the civil service was because he thought that as a reformer, it was quite difficult for him to head the organisation, because if he came up with radical reform ideas, he was used to somebody a bit more senior going, that's quite a good idea, Jeremy, but maybe we should just rein it back a little bit. But, you know, actually, I think he found that when he was in that role, it worked absolutely fine. He surrounded himself with people who could, you know, provide a little bit of balance. So Jeremy actually really welcomed, you know, people like Steve Hilton. Again, I think it's kind of clear in the story. You know, he welcomed people like that who would come in and put in radical ideas, so long as he was able to curb the most extreme versions. But a lot of it he kind of welcomed. I think where Jeremy was more cautious was structural changes. So machinery of government changes, as they're called. So you know, kind of breaking up Department A and merging Department A and Department B. And the issue with that, and I speak as somebody who's written a whole book on kind of reorganizing kind of companies, is that it's massively expensive to do it. You know, you just think about kind of the cost of moving all the civil servants around, you know, changing all the IT systems, you know, putting up all the new notices, moving the buildings. And actually, that doesn't necessarily change that much. So things like, you know, reforms like making the civil service more commercial, bringing in more commercial abilities, making it much more digital, doing a massive push on diversity, reducing the number of layers in the civil service, you know, things like this, you know, reforms like that, Jeremy was very passionate about. Machinery of government changes, structural changes, he was very reluctant to do too many of, because I think he found them very disruptive and very expensive.
Would Jeremy have preferred at one stage not to have been head of the civil service and to have concentrated much more on policy and being secretary to the cabinet?
When David Cameron first called him in, and I actually say this in the book, when David Cameron first called him in and said, I'd like you to be my cabinet secretary, David Cameron said, I'd like you to be my cabinet secretary and retain the role that you currently have as head of 10 Downing Street and being my chief policy advisor. So Jeremy was going to take those two roles, you know, chief policy advisor and cabinet secretary, so overseeing the cabinet, and also the kind of permanent secretary of the cabinet office. So it's kind of those three roles Jeremy was going to take, but he wasn't going to take the role of head of the civil service. So that's kind of managing the civil service and all the different departments. And that was very deliberate, because many of Jeremy's predecessors have not taken on that role as of chief policy advisor, and therefore they have had capacity to do the cabinet secretary job and the head of the civil service job. And I think Jeremy, first of all, felt very passionate about the policy work that he did, and kind of Cameron really valued it. And I think they were very determined not to lose that role. And I think Jeremy was also slightly cautious about becoming head of the civil service, because he'd never run a department. So he was worried he would not be credible as head of the civil service. He also had a bit of a loathing, given he was quite a kind of introverted person in a way, of giving lots and lots of speeches. You know, being the front man was not his favourite thing to do at all. However, what then happened was that they appointed someone to be the head of the civil service, and they had Jeremy. And ultimately, that was a very difficult structure. I think organisations really struggle with a kind of dual leadership. And in the end, that fell apart and Jeremy was asked to take on both. And the second time he was asked, he did. He was very nervous about it. But actually, then he grew into it. And he, I wouldn't say he ever enjoyed giving speeches, but he was very surprised by how much people liked them. And they weren't anywhere near as disastrous as he thought that they might be. And what it gave him was a wonderful opportunity to reform the civil service. And that's what he became very passionate about, particularly towards the end of his life. So, you know, issues around diversity, you know, increasing policy innovation within the civil service, increasing commercialization, increasing digital within the civil service. Those were all things that he could do once he became head of the civil service, which he wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
I mean, what it looks like is he made every job a reform job. You know, he may have been asked to manage the civil service. He wasn't interested. He wanted to reform it. Now, one more sort of thing, again, going back to the Catholic Churchill, it does help, doesn't it, that each side in a coalition, at least, or, you know, in a prime minister-chancellor relationship, had somebody who can talk informally with Jeremy, and then that settles a lot of issues which the top guys can't actually get into. And I think that's a very interesting part of the machinery of the system. I mean, Norman knows all about it. But you do need some kind of glue like that, which makes things happen.
I agree. And many governments have something similar, sometimes a bit more formalized and sometimes more informal. But, you know, the whole cabinet system, for example, in Europe works in a similar sort of way, which is to have a group of very well-informed people around each commissioner who can pre-negotiate issues. The Sherpa system that we have with the G7 works in a similar sort of way. The idea of having people who can go in ahead of the negotiations and try to resolve things. And, you know, Cafe Churchill was a more informal way of doing this very similar sort of thing. But it certainly makes it much easier, I believe, and Norman will have a view of this, to have that sort of contact at official level or official special advisor level to try to resolve issues rather than doing them all at principal to principal level.
I wanted to ask briefly about Brexit. We haven't talked much about that. We won't talk much about it, but in a conversation with Norman before Christmas when no deal threatened, I can remember Norman saying in passing, if Jeremy were here, we would have sorted this out already, he said. And in your book, you talk about Jeremy right away spotting that Brexit would go round in circles on Ireland. But do you think he thought that would ever be solved?
So I think Jeremy was absolutely convinced it would be solved. I mean, there's always a solution. But unfortunately, most solutions do require a degree of compromise on all sides. So I think the kind of tricky thing with Brexit, and he said this to me, and I have it in the book, you know, not long before he died, was that we had one decision through a referendum vote, and we had another opinion, which was the opinion held, if you like, by Parliament. They're both legitimate kind of parts of our democracy. And if those two parts of our democracy disagree, and they're both legitimate, you've got a problem. And he saw that, and effectively it was going to get to a point where one or the other would have to be adjusted, because you can't have two completely legitimate forms of democracy arguing with each other on the right outcome. But you're right, he did spot very early on that Ireland was going to be right at the crux of this. And I have a kind of conversation very, very soon after the kind of Brexit vote where Jeremy's saying Ireland is the big issue here. And I was very surprised by that. I hadn't figured out at that point how big an issue it was going to be.
Coming from India and having looked at the Irish problem from a very different perspective, I was much more aware of the Irish division. You know, you look at the map, the UK is not in one single pack. It is two different things. And then the English always forget the Irish. I mean, it's kind of a thousand year of history. What is, again, to come back to this thing, the conflict between the referendum and the parliament was because, in a sense, not just the parliament, but the division within the ruling party, which is what basically was causing a problem. And this is where I think Theresa may face more difficulties. Maybe she shouldn't have had the 2017 election, but that's where she faced the most difficulty. And had the Labour Party been slightly better behaved, you know, they could have supported her and got a better Brexit, which they wanted, but they wouldn't do it.
I describe in the book those meetings that Theresa May, Mrs. May, used to have every week, which were between kind of Ollie Robbins, who was bringing back from Brussels the view of what Brussels would accept, and the advisers who were bringing, Nick and Fee in particular, who were bringing a sense of what the Conservative Party would accept. Jeremy trying to make sure that all the different views were heard, Mrs. May and various, and those were very difficult meetings, because it was very clear, I think, to everybody in the room that there was very, I mean, usually in most of the policy debates I describe in the book, you could see a landing zone, even if that landing zone was quite small, where everybody's interests would overlap. You know, nobody would get exactly what they wanted, but everybody would get enough of what they wanted to kind of go home happy. And I think the issue on that debate was that it was very hard to see where that space was. It was very hard to see a space which was going to enable everybody to kind of walk away happy. And that was why kind of ultimately, as I say, you know, kind of shortly before Jeremy died, he felt that there was going to have to be some sort of shift in terms of the kind of parliament or the referendum or something, because there was so much misalignment, it was very hard to see how an agreed position could be reached.
Well, you're often describing, Suzanne, in the book, crises which Jeremy's helping a prime minister to manage. Was he happier helping solve crises, or did he prefer considering policy on a proactive basis? Sometimes he was helping react, sometimes he was helping propose. Which do you think he preferred?
Oh, he definitely preferred proposing, because when you're proposing policies, you're moving things forward. I mean, when you're solving a crisis, it's a very important part of the job, but you're often trying to sweep up a problem that's emerged of whatever sort it is, you know, whether it be kind of Leveson or a banking crisis or whatever it is, but you're trying to minimize damage that has been created by whatever the circumstances are. Whereas when you're proposing a policy, you're often, you know, unilaterally taking the country to hopefully a kind of better place. So all of the work that he did, for example, there's a lot of work in there from the Nudge Unit, you know, kind of introducing electronic cigarettes or introducing the minimum wage much earlier. Jeremy did believe in kind of foundation hospitals. I mean, all of these were not responses to crises. These were, you know, policies that people believed were positive policies. The sugar tax, for example, which he very strongly believed in as well, or same-sex marriages. All of these are things that weren't in response to a crisis, but were things that certainly Jeremy felt very strongly about, and the ministers he was working for felt very strongly about. Absolutely, you would say, well, Jeremy made more of an impact together with the ministers he worked with in a crisis, because if you don't manage a crisis well, it can massively damage the country. So the impact might be great to managing the crisis, but you often only end up coming out the other end just having minimised the damage, not actually having taken very much of a step further forward.
But, you know, when a crisis happens, it hits you unanticipated completely. And then you have to sort of think in a very different way than when you're trying to reform something with a little bit of advance notice. So these two different aspects of running the country, you know, and you need someone to have both sort of abilities of responding at once and then planning ahead and taking the long path. And very few people can do two things like that.
I agree. And Jeremy did an awful lot of kind of fixing crises. And he had a certain kind of methodology to doing that, which, again, I try to describe or give some examples to describe. And fundamentally, what he did was, you know, if you had a crisis, he tried to get down to the pretty nitty gritty detail of what that issue was in order to be able to fix it. He didn't believe that because, certainly towards the end of his career, he was one of the most senior people in the room, that therefore he should hover 5,000 miles above the problem and tell somebody else to go and fix it. He would be right in the detail, you know, looking at an issue early on in his career when he did the foot and mouth crisis, really understanding the detail of what was going on. But even little things, you know, like he did the whole thing around badger culling and spent this kind of quite an amusing little kind of anecdote of badger weekend, where he went in and had to kind of understand in a number of hours exactly what was happening with the badger culls and then what to do and then take a decision. I hasten to add, this is a man who knew nothing about the countryside. I think I say also in the book that he and I once walked across a field when we'd only just met, we were dating. We were walking across a field and Jeremy screamed and pointed with a kind of quivering hand at something in the field. And he said, "It's a massive rat."
Right. So I looked at it with a rabbit. I remember that very much. Yes.
Yep. Not a very kind of country or, but he, you know, but when it got to something like the kind of culling of the badgers or foot and mouth crisis, all of a sudden Jeremy would become an expert on whatever it was, understand it in immense detail, and then move on to the next thing.
Suzanne, I wonder if you could just describe to us a bit about Jeremy's illness when you discovered that he was terminally ill, and how difficult it was for him to carry on working, helping Theresa May with the tremendous problems over Brexit. That must have been an enormously testing time for you, and also how you came to decide to write the book.
So Jeremy, and I try to kind of explain this as I tell the story, sadly was never a very well man. I mean, from the moment I met him, he was a little unwell. He had various kind of chronic ailments. And he became kind of, you know, more and more unwell in a slightly kind of unspecified way as we moved towards, it was kind of 2017 and the kind of Theresa May election. And he went off for a whole series of tests, actually, through the kind of back end of 2016 and the first part of 2017. And it was actually, I think it was pretty much the day, and I've got it recorded in the book, that Theresa May was re-elected, that he got a call from his GP. The GP had sent him off for a scan, and a GP kind of came on the phone and said, "I'm very worried about what I've seen on the scan, and you need to go and see an oncologist." And sadly, you know, it turned out that he had lung cancer, and that progressed very quickly. So he only had about 18 months after that. We got slightly longer than we expected because I spent a lot of time investigating the sort of mutation that he had and discovered that there are quite a lot of trials going on. I mean, the medical science, as we've all discovered during COVID, is moving incredibly fast. And I found a trial set of drugs that was being run by MD Anderson in Texas and managed to get them to let him go on those trial drugs. And according to his oncologist, that gave him several more months. So we were given some extra time, which I'm very grateful for. But still, most of that last year and a half, when we were in the middle of the Brexit crisis, Jeremy was dealing with, you know, progressively getting kind of more and more and more unwell, endless kind of doctor's appointments, quite a lot of pain. He increasingly couldn't really walk. I mean, I put the speeches from the prime ministers in the back of the book. And one of the things that Theresa May says in her speech was, "When Jeremy couldn't come to you, you went to him." And that was a kind of reference to the fact that towards the end, he sat in his office because he really couldn't move. And everybody came to see him, including the prime minister, because he really wasn't mobile. But, you know, what he was absolutely determined to do all the way through that period was to keep working. And some people will say, well, that's a absolutely crazy thing to do. Why would you do that when you're that unwell and you're kind of terminally ill? But for him, it was two things. One is, you know, he was immensely dedicated to what he did. There is this issue of if he'd stepped aside, who was going to step in, you know, certainly at very short notice, in the middle of a major crisis around Brexit. And then, frankly, there was also a more personal element of this, which was as long as he kept working, as long as he was doing that, it was a massive distraction from thinking about the illness. I mean, as far as he was concerned, he wanted to think about the illness as little as possible. It was a kind of major irritation and quite an annoyance. And quite often I was being kind of told off for dragging him out of important meetings to go for annoying scans or meet yet another doctor. But so it was really two things. It was a kind of dedication to his work. And then quite frankly, it was a way to kind of cope with what was a absolutely terrible situation. And I have to say, writing the book served a bit of the same purpose. So we we started writing the book a year before he passed away, and it became a shared project and a very positive, forward-looking thing because it was his opportunity to give back to the civil service. And I have to say, to a much wider readership, his memories of all of those years and what the civil service does and how it operates and everything else. And he was very proud of it and very kind of pleased with it. And luckily it had come together before he died, and he was able to read about 90% of it. It needed a lot more editing and a lot more work afterwards, but it was there in its essence. And that was also a very kind of positive part of that last year.
I didn't know if you knew, Susan. When he worked for me, he wasn't well. And he went to hospital when he was working for me. I forget in which job. He only had one lung, didn't he? Or one functioning lung.
He suffered from lung collapses, which runs in his family. So his brother had lung collapses, and his father. And both of Jeremy's lungs collapsed at various points and then got stuck back up again.
Thank you very much, Suzanne, for joining us today. That was fascinating. And thank you for taking us through this amazing journey into Jeremy's interesting and challenging life. Thank you also, Meghnad and Norman, for your support and insight. And thank you, listeners, for listening. If you enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe to our channel, which you can find on Apple Podcast and Spotify.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.